Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we are diving into medieval village life, everyday existence between field and church.
And this is actually the heart of the era, something that's far too rarely discussed. Because when we think of the Middle Ages, most people picture castles, knights, magnificent cities with marketplaces.
True, yet that was the absolute exception. Over 90% of the population lived in the countryside, in villages. Many people visited a town at most for market day or a pilgrimage, if at all.
90%! Just imagine that. We're not talking about a majority here. That's essentially the entire society. Towns were basically tiny islands in a vast sea of villages and farmland.
And what many people don't realize, being a town in the Middle Ages was a legal status, not a matter of size. A settlement needed town rights, market rights, usually also a town wall. In the High and Late Middle Ages alone, between 1100 and 1400, hundreds, if not thousands of towns were founded in German-speaking areas. Freiburg, in 1118, was one of the starting shots for this founding wave. And most of these were tiny market towns.
That puts things into perspective. Even if you lived in a so-called town, it was often not much more than a larger village with special privileges. The vibrant life took place in the villages.
They were the true backbone of society. Without the villages, no food, no raw materials, no labor. The towns could only exist because the rural population supplied them.
And that's exactly what we are going to examine more closely today. The social structure in such a village. Who was in charge, who was at the bottom, then everyday life,
the hard work in the fields, the festivals, the cycle of the year.
And also the infrastructure. Church, mill, bakehouse. What was actually there in such a village? And finally, trade. Because villages also developed economically.
What fascinates me most, personally, is this close connection with nature. People lived completely in rhythm with the seasons. No calendar on the wall, but the position of the sun, the state of the fields, and of course the church calendar, determined what needed to be done.
And this community, whether you wanted it or not, you depended on each other. The harvest was brought in together. The commons, the collectively used lands, were worked together. You couldn't simply opt out.
That naturally had its downsides too. The social control was immense. Everyone knew everyone. But there was also this solidarity, this reliability that we no longer know today.
Interestingly, there were also major differences in the village types themselves. Depending on the region and landscape, quite different structures developed. Cluster villages that simply grew irregularly. Street villages along a main axis. Green villages around a central square.
And in southern Germany, it looked different again than in the north. The soil conditions, the climate, the lordship relations. Everything played a role.
That's exactly where we'll go deeper now. Let's start with a variety of these village forms and see how they affected people's lives.
Absolutely. And these basic types wonderfully show how pragmatic and adaptable people were back then.
And each type had its own logic behind it.
The cluster village is probably the oldest form. They often emerged in the early Middle Ages, from around the 8th or 9th century. The farmsteads stood simply higgledy-piggledy next to each other, often grouped around a pond or spring. No plan behind it. They grew organically.
This was especially typical in long-settled regions, western and southern Germany, for example. Good soil played a part, but what really mattered was the settlement history and lordship. Farmers settled there, and then more joined. Over generations, a maze of farmsteads and small lanes developed.
Then there were the street villages, which developed along a
main axis. You find these particularly where an important through road existed or a stream structured the settlement.
In hillier regions or along river valleys, this was the most practical solution. The farmsteads stood in rows, behind them the long field strips. In eastern Germany, in Brandenburg or Saxony, you can still see this very clearly today.
Forest strip villages are their own village type. There, the farmsteads stood in a row, usually along a stream or path, and each farmer basically received a long strip of land that reached from the house all the way into the forest. Everything arranged in parallel, very well thought out.
And then the green villages. That's my personal favorite. There the houses cluster around a central square, the village green. Often oval or lens-shaped, with a pond in the middle for the livestock.
Oh, that makes sense. So the village green wasn't just a meeting place, but had a very practical function as pasture.
And for protection. When danger threatened, the livestock could be quickly driven into the village center. This form emerged mainly in the High Middle Ages, especially during the Eastern colonization from the 12th century onward.
So those were planned foundations?
Often, yes. The territorial lords recruited settlers and laid out the villages according to a system. In the West, the irregularly grown cluster villages dominate. In the East, the planned green and street villages. You can still read that in the village structure to this day.
When you drive through Brandenburg, you actually see that. These oval village squares with the church at the edge, the farmsteads around it, those are often still medieval layouts.
Exactly. These planned structures are like a map of settlement history. They show that it wasn't just about practicality, but also about lordship and organization.
The fascinating thing about it is that the landscape really determined which form emerged. Flat land, lots of space, cluster village. Narrow valleys or trade routes, street village. Open areas with livestock farming, green village.
People adapted to their environment, not the other way around. And these structures have endured for centuries. When you walk through older villages today, you can often still recognize the medieval basic form, despite all the later construction.
Especially in parts of eastern Germany, where much was preserved despite many redesigns.
That makes this region so interesting for living history too. In some green villages in Brandenburg or Saxony-Anhalt, you're practically still standing in a medieval layout. The village green might be a lawn with a playground today, but the form is the same.
The social structure in the medieval village was strictly hierarchical, and the decisive factor was land ownership. Whoever had land had power. Whoever had none was dependent.
At the very top stood the yeoman farmers, the full peasants. They had enough land to feed their family and still pay dues. Often 30, 40 morgen or more. These were the respected families in the village.
And then there were half-peasants, quarter-peasants, smallholders. A whole gradation downward, depending on land ownership. The half-peasants could just about feed themselves, but often needed side income. The smallholders might still have a small plot, a garden.
And at the very bottom, the cottages, the landless villages. they truly had nothing, except perhaps a small cottage, a hut at the edge of the village.
The cottagers depended on day labor. At harvest time, threshing, herding cattle, wherever work came up. They lived from hand to mouth, had hardly any rights in the village community, and often couldn't have a say in decisions.
And how did someone even become a
cottager? Often through inheritance law. That's a crucial point.
Partible inheritance?
Originally, yes. With partible inheritance, the property was divided equally among all heirs. Sounds fair at first, doesn't it? But imagine, a farm of 30 morgen. The farmer dies, has three sons. Each gets 10 morgen. The next generation, again three sons. Suddenly, each has only 3 morgen. No family can live on that.
That explains the impoverishment over generations.
The farms kept getting smaller, the parcels ever narrower. In some regions, you could read this in the landscape. These long, narrow strips that partly arose from divisions, though some were laid out that way from the start. In the southwest, this was especially pronounced. In Baden, Württemberg, Franconia.
In the north and northeast, by contrast, impartible inheritance became established. There, only one child, usually the eldest son, inherited the entire farm. It remained intact, economically viable.
But that also had harsh consequences for the other siblings. They often came away with nothing or received only a small settlement. Many had to work as farmhands or maids on other farms. Some migrated away.
That's how part of the landless lower class emerged. Siblings who didn't get their share of the inheritance. They had no choice. Either work on their brother's farm or scrape by as day laborers.
So both systems had their downsides. With partible inheritance, everyone became impoverished in the long run. With impartible inheritance, only the non-heirs, but immediately.
And then there were the craftsmen and shepherds. They stood somewhere in between, didn't they?
They had a special position. The village blacksmith, the miller if there was one, the wheelwright, they were important for the community, often had a certain standing. But most of them didn't have much land either. They lived from their work, often as a sideline to their own small farming.
The shepherds, on the other hand, stood rather low socially. They tended the livestock on the commons, were outside a lot, often lived at the margins of the village community, literally and socially.
This hierarchy was quite rigid. A cottager could practically never rise to become a full peasant. The system reproduced itself over generations. Marriages usually took place within one's own class. A yeoman's son didn't marry a cottager's daughter.
Still, everyone depended on each other. At harvest time, the yeomen needed the cottagers as laborers, and the cottagers needed this work to survive. A harsh dependency, but also a connection. Daily life in the medieval village was completely determined by agriculture. There was no separation between work and life. The two were one. The day began at sunrise and ended at sunset. Artificial light existed, but it was expensive and impractical for working.
During harvest time, that meant 15-16 hours of work in summer. In winter, perhaps only 8. The natural rhythm dictated everything. When you got up, when you ate, when you slept.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And the cycle of the year was, well, in spring they plowed and sowed. Then came the hay harvest, then the grain harvest in late summer. In autumn, the grape harvest, where there was wine. And finally, the winter work indoors.
From medieval books of hours and calendars, we know these routines quite precisely. There are illustrations of the monthly labors. February often shows farmers by the fire, June the hay mowing, September the grape harvest.
What was special was this sense of community. Much wasn't done alone, but together. The harvest, above all. Everyone helped with that. Even the day labourers who otherwise had few rights. Every pair of hands counted.
That's a perfect transition to the commons, the collectively used land.
The commons encompassed everything that didn't belong to individual farms. Pasture land, forest, ponds, moors. Usage rights were often tied to farm ownership, so not equal for everyone, but according to fixed rules. Driving livestock to the common pasture, fetching wood from the forest, fishing in the ponds.
And these rules were?
Established by the village community itself. For a long time, purely customary law. From the late Middle Ages onward, the rules were then written down in village law codes. People simply knew what was allowed and what wasn't. How many animals you could send to pasture. When wood could be cut.
This worked remarkably well for centuries. Restrictions did occur from the High Middle Ages onward, but from the 15th century it became truly massive. The so-called enclosure of the commons. That was then one of several factors that led to the Peasants' Wars of 1524-25. The peasants fought for their ancient rights.
Besides fieldwork, there were also craftsmen in the village. The blacksmith, the wheelwright, perhaps a cooper. But most practiced their craft as a sideline. They were also farmers and only worked as craftsmen when needed.
A pure craftsman could rarely survive in the village. The demand was too small for that. So smithing was done in winter or pottery made, while in summer everyone stood in the fields.
But what really structured the year were the
festivals, the church holidays above all.
Those were sacred in the truest sense. On Sundays and holidays, work was forbidden, and there were many of them. Easter, Pentecost, Christmas, of course, but also dozens of saints' days, patron festivals of the village church.
Some historians estimate that medieval peasants weren't allowed, or didn't have, to work on over 100 days a year, depending on how you look at it. Do the math. 52 Sundays plus 40 to 80 church festivals, depending on the diocese, that adds up.
The harvest festivals were especially important. After the grain harvest, after the grape harvest, that's when people celebrated, ate, drank. It welded the community together. It gave the hard daily life a rhythm and meaning.
This connection of work, nature and community is something we hardly know anymore today. Every day, every season had its task. People didn't live against nature, but with it.
And these festivals were also the only occasions when everyone really came together. From the yeoman farmer to the day labourer. That's when the social differences were less noticeable for a moment.
Let's look at the infrastructure in the medieval village. It was simple, but certain buildings were absolutely central to communal life.
The church, first and foremost. It wasn't just the spiritual center, but also the most important meeting place. News was announced there, disputes settled. Decisions made.
The church bells structured the day to work, to rest, to prayer. Sundials existed too, but for most people, the bells were the most important time signal.
And then the mill. That was at least as important, perhaps even more essential.
Absolutely. From the 12th century onward, the so-called milling obligation became established. Peasants had to have their grain milled at the manorial mill, nowhere else. Barbarossa issued the milling prerogative in 1158, part of the Roncalian laws, which then strengthened these seigneurial rights.
So that was a monopoly.
A very profitable one. The miller kept a portion of the grain as payment, the so-called Multure, named after the measure of the same name. The proportion varied regionally, often between a tenth and a thirtieth, depending on the type of grain. And the lord collected rent. Anyone who didn't comply was
punished. Severely, even.
Control was maintained through tally sticks. Every bushel was notched. The miller had one half, the farmer the other. That way, no one could cheat. At least in theory.
That also explains the bad reputation of millers. They were often considered dishonest because they sat at this crucial juncture.
It was similar with the bakehouse. That too was used communally, often with a baking obligation. Each household had specific times when they could use the oven. This saved firewood and minimized the fire risk.
In the cramped villages with half-timbered houses, an open fire in your own home was an enormous risk. A communal bakehouse with a stone oven was much safer.
Inns, by the way, were
not in every village. Only on through roads or in larger places.
But where they existed, they were important meeting points. News arrived there, travelling merchants brought goods and tidings from outside.
Economic networking increased significantly over the course of the Middle Ages. When a village produced surpluses, more grain than needed, wool, linen, pottery, it could trade with them.
The emerging money economy accelerated this further. Previously, much was done through barter and payments in kind. But with coins, exchange became more flexible. Suddenly, you could sell at markets in town and buy other things with the money.
That also changed the village community. Whoever traded successfully could rise. The old order began to crack.
Looking back at it all now, the medieval village was far more than just a collection of huts and fields. It was a complex community with its own structure, its own rules, its own dynamics.
And above all, it was the living space for the vast majority of the population. Anyone who wants to understand the Middle Ages must understand the village.
Not the castle, not the cathedral, the village. That's where real life took place, where people worked, celebrated, were born and died.
And these structures, this rhythm, much of it can still be found in rural regions today. Changed, of course, but the basic patterns are often remarkably enduring.
That's it for today on medieval village life. If you're interested in topics like this, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. You'll find many more fascinating articles about history in the blog.
And of course, also the right products, if you want to experience history yourself. Until next time.
Goodbye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.